this land is yours. This land is mine. From California to New York, from the redwood forest to Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went walking that ribbon of highway, I saw love made that endless skyway, and I saw below me a golden valley, and I said this land was made for you and me.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio Show. Welcome to the show, everyone. Here we believe that if the people speak, we can make a difference. Tonight, the people speak with writer, director, producer, Philippe Diaz of Cinema Libre Studios. Like we here at the People Speak believe that our voices can make a difference, so does the Cinema Libre Studio believe that movies can make a difference. This company is a haven for independent filmmakers with views offering a variety of different productions, co-production, distribution, foreign sales and marketing, as well as post-production services. Their headquarters are in Los Angeles, and the company is best known for distributing in theaters and on DVD titles that include Outfoxed, Uncovered, Tim Robbins, Embedded Live, Giuliani Time, and ESPN's Through the Fire. In the past 5 months, Cinema Libre Studios productions have won 4 awards, including Conventioneers, winner of the 206 Independent Spirit Awards for John Cassavetes Award and the Best Feature at the Miami International Film Festival. The Empire in Africa won the Best Documentary in the Slam Dance Festival 206, and Giuliani Time won the Best Documentary at the Silver Lake Film Festival in 206. Welcome, Philippe. It is an honor having you with us tonight. How are you?
I'm fine. It's my pleasure to be here.
And you have a wonderful, magnificent French accent, which it happens to be my favorite accent in the whole world.
Oh,
so I am especially honored tonight.
That's a pleasure. If you think that the French accent is good, it's wonderful.
Well, it is. It is indeed. Can you tell us a little bit about Cinema Libre Studios and how you came about on even coming and attempting such an incredible project? This is really huge. I mean, all of the movies that have come out of your production company is just amazing. It's stunning. How did you come about this?
Well, I would say the reality is that, you know, I'm surrounded by a team of very devoted people and who are working very hard, and we all believe here that, you know, it's true that movie can make a difference, and we are here to do that. So Cinema Libre was created. We created the mother company of Cinema Libre is 15 years old, so we have been doing producing and distributing movie, which can make a difference, you know, for 15 years. But we created the concept of Cinema Libre like 5 years ago because we were able to put together our production, distribution, foreign sales activity together with a post-production company as well. So because we believe that, of course, it's hard to make movies and to distribute them, but it's also hard to even make them, like, technically speaking, at the highest level of quality. Today in the world of entertainment, if you are not at this highest level of quality, it's very hard to go anywhere. And we realized that there was a lot of filmmakers who have wonderful ideas and possibility to make movies, but who are so tight in their budget or so limited in their technical abilities that we decided to put all that together and created this mini studio, if you want to say, who can do that, and again, devoted to socially or politically conscious film, or again, movies that can make a difference. So it started also because, meaning there was a big change in the fact that we were, in fact, doing more feature films before and less documentaries, but we decided to distribute Outfoxed, and it was such a huge success. Then, of course, you know, in Hollywood, people remember you for what you did yesterday, not what you have been doing for 15 years, just what you did yesterday. So therefore, we became, in like 5 minutes, the distributor of documentaries, you know, in the U.S., which is great because, you know, we love to do documentaries, and we have been doing, you know, probably several dozens, you know, up to now, and which is great. And again, which are all, you know, politically or socially conscious films, you know, issue-related films, you know, which is great. And, and that is, of course, you know, that's a very good thing for us, you know. But, you know, to give you some other title, we have been doing anything from The Future of Food, which is about environment, to, you know, America, Freedom to Fascism by the late Aaron Russo, about the tax issue. We have been doing, you know, of course, you mentioned Julie Anytime, Darfur Diaries, which is the first movie about Darfur. We are releasing soon Angel in the Dust, which is about AIDS, children of AIDS in Africa. You know, so we have a wide range of issues, and we are, as you know, producing as well documentaries. You know, we are.
Philippe, are you specifically documentary and social conscious genre specific, or is there? Are you willing to kind of look at any form of cinema?
Meaning, I would say 99%, or let's say 95%, to be honest. You know, are definitely, you know, politically and culturally and socially conscious films. Now we are open to any, you know, filmmakers who really has a different view. You know, we are here, you know, we don't think that we are here to compete with major studio or more commercial places. I don't think Hollywood needs another company like that, and it's not what we are, you know, like in terms of individual. So we are definitely related to that. We are definitely relating to this kind of film. Now, that said, any filmmaker who has a different view, or let's say artistically speaking, or who needs, you know, a place to, you know, to welcome his, you know, his different point of view, will be open. Like, for example, we just produced the latest Eric Beiler film. Eric Beiler is the director who did Charlotte Sometimes, and I think he's one of the most talented, you know, young American filmmaker, you know, of the young generation. And when I saw Charlotte Sometimes, I was so impressed that I contacted him and said, look, if you have another movie that you want to submit to us, we would be very happy to produce it. And we did. It's called Trey, and it will be released like before the end of the year in theaters. You know, so that is not political per se, but it has a different meaning. I think Eric has a very, again, very strong artistic point of view, number one. And number two, he has a different way to look at young people today. So it's not political per se, but it's different, you know. So that's a good example. So I would say, yes, we're open to anything which is different, anything which has a strong view on things.
Philippe, what is the process for selecting a filmmaker or a production from these independent people that show up at Cinema Libre's doorstep?
Well, you know, there is no rules like that because, you know, we receive like so many submissions, you know, every week that we have a hard time even to go through them. And, you know, and many times we have to apologize to filmmakers who think that, you know, it's really unfair that they have been waiting weeks. But, you know, we are so overwhelmed by submission that, of course, it's very hard. So I would say, you know, of course, we receive things in the mail that we try to look at and we select some. This way, other time it's filmmakers that we know contacted us and say, oh, you know, we know each other. Here is my new movie. Do you want it? Some other times the producers. Some, like for example, for Angels in the Dust, the one in children's orphans of AIDS in Africa. You know, it was Participant Productions. You know, the Jeff Skoll company. You know, that we got in touch with and asked us to distribute the movie. It's, you know, it can be like many, many different. There's no rules like that. Oh, of course, like for example, in the case of Eric Beiler, it's me who went to him and say, hey, you did such a great movie that, you know, we want to produce your next movie. So there is no rules. You know, again, we develop also our own material. Like for example, you know, it's right that we buy books or screenplays or whatever to develop project. We have We have been working for a long time on a movie about Palestine, for example. Or
really?
You know,
that's
yes.
very interesting. I'm Palestinian. I'm a Palestinian-American,
oh,
and I'm an and I'm an activist. So I am certainly very, very interested in that. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, in fact, it's funny because we have been we have been for a long time trying to distribute things about that. We distributed a movie called The Shape of the Future, which is, you know, about the problem and explaining the two sides of the conflict, but we distributed it in DVD. We're distributing another one very soon, which is from a producer, and which is called Palestinian Blues, from a producer that we know and gave it to us for distribution, called Palestinian Blues. And that's another one that we developed in full production was someone who was working with us called Nicole Balivian, and she had a wonderful screenplay called Sleeping on Stones about the conflict there, which is a wonderful project. So, you know, we have been, you know, any issue which needs, you know, I would say there is another way to phrase it, and there is someone who was at the head of the Hollywood Film Festival has a great way to say it. He says it's giving a voice to the voiceless, and that's exactly what we are trying to do. You know, we are trying every time that we have the feeling that somewhere in the world there is an unfair situation and people need to get a voice, that's what we try to do. Like, for example, I produced and directed this Empire in Africa that you mentioned, which is about, you know, the civil war in Sierra Leone. And that was exactly what it was. You know, I went there and made this movie because, you know, everything that we could hear in the news, in the mass media, was so unfair and so, to not say untrue, you know, that there is a moment that you have to do something about it, and it's why I did this movie. So, you know, it's all about that. It's all trying to give, again, a voice to the voiceless.
Well, that's an amazing concept in and of itself, and of course, socially conscious film, I think, is pretty much in the underground still. No matter how much we want to see it in the media, in the world, in theaters, I still feel like it's like a second billing. How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, I think there was a big change in the last probably, you know, I would say 7 years. You know, there was a big change, and I attribute it, and I may be wrong, but I think that it comes from what the television became. Because if you think about it, if you want to have real news and very serious, you know, report or analysis on some problems in the world, where do you go today? When you sit in front of your TV, what do you watch? You know, 10 years ago, you could eventually watch CNN, but I think CNN, you know, disappeared when it was sold to Time Warner. You know, it started, you know, from very serious inquiries, around the world. They are now doing reporting on the dog show next door. You know, and
so
what is left in the U.S. if you want to have real news? You have BBC, okay, fine, but not really American, and very few people watch BBC. You have what? You have Free Speech TV and Link TV, you know, that nobody is watching, or even very few people probably know it even exists. So I think there is a realization of the audience that, you know, the news that you see on TV, on the mass media I'm talking about, you know, is unfair and biased, and, you know, and you can't rely on it. And the large audience is starting to look at other media to know the truth, you know. And it's why you can see, like, very successful endeavor like Democracy Now!, you know, Amy Goodman, or Pacifica Radio, and all these kind of outlets where, you know, that you rely more on than the mass media. And it's why I think people started to realize that the independent movie theaters with documentaries, you know, are a better source of information, in fact, than the mass media. And it's why I think in the last 7 years we had seen like a very, very strong increase in theatrical attendees, you know, who are going to see, you know, documentaries in DVD sales. Now you have, of course, the digital download that you can get everywhere, you know, and that is, I think there's a major change. And I think that, of course, we are, again, benefiting from the fact that, you know, you can't see anything any more interesting on television. You know, if you had, like a lot of channels like Democracy Now! All over the place, who give you like real programs or real documentaries like Free Speech TV or whatever, you know, we would not have such success in a way. But of course, you know, again, if you want to have real news, where do you go? I don't know. You know, again, you go to Free Speech TV, but you know, it's very
limited. Well, I think, well, as a grassroots organization, that is exactly how the People Speak came about.
Right.
Instead of arguing with each other, we decided to give the people a voice,
absolutely,
someplace where they could speak and hear the truth from people like you, cinematographers, and people in the media, our Congress, our Senate, and we've had them all here. And it's amazing, and I think you're right. I think there has been a change. Not only has there been a change, but in my opinion, I think that people have really almost gotten their fill and are fated by sixth-grade mentality media.
Right.
And now we are almost hungry for something of substance, something that is more, that resonates truth, and I think this is where your type of work, the Empire of Africa, you speak about going to a civil war, and the responsibility of us as Occidental countries, and you lay a lot of the blame on us. Perhaps you can talk to us about this.
Yeah, that's kind of an amazing experience, actually, to say the least. Normally I was not supposed to direct this movie. I was only supposed to produce it. I had partnered with an organization called Action Against Hunger, which is this wonderful organization. It was, unfortunately, it's not as much anymore, but which was, you know, not only distributing bag of rice to starving people, but they were trying to explain that, in fact, any hunger problem in the world is not due to drought or to women have too many children, like the kind of stupid things that you can hear all over the place, but it was because of political reasons, and we decided to make a movie about that, and we picked the worst case that there was at this time. We shot, in fact, the movie in 1999, and it was the worst part of the world, was Sierra Leone, and of course, I had contacted a lot of filmmakers, you know, that I knew, documentary filmmakers, to do this movie, and they were all very excited because they thought, oh, by the time we are ready to go, the civil war would be, you know, finished, and we'll be able to go and shoot and see and explain what happened. And unfortunately, when we had to go, the civil war was not finished at all, and it was, of course, very dangerous, and everybody turned me down. And I was at the point where I had to decide either to do it myself or to cancel the project. It's why I decided to do it. But the reality, what was very interesting, is that the thing that you could see in the media, in all the media, even the most serious publication, like doesn't matter if it's the New York Times or the Time in London or Le Monde in France or whatever it is, the biggest and the most interesting publication, was that you had these bloodthirsty barbarian rebels who had been fomenting this rebellion for the last 10 years and who were just, you know, interested in diamond mines and maiming people and this and that. And you were, when you were reading these very serious papers, you would hear about, in the news, of course, the same, you would hear about millions of amputees, you know, by these rebels. And, you know, Sierra Leone is a 4.5 million people country. So if you have millions of amputees, it means that at least 1 person on 2 is amputated. You know, so when we arrived there, we thought that we would see amputees all over the place. And it took us weeks to not even see one. And we said, well, where are these amputees? And to make a long story short, is that the whole international press had been manipulated by the government in place, which had been forced in place by the United Nations with totally rigged election, et cetera, et cetera. Whatever, everything is in the movie, you know, and they had created a little camp where they had put 200 amputees next to the airport and next to the only international hotel in Freetown, the capital, which was still open. And they would invite every international journalist who would want to come here and say, look, we can't guarantee your security. You can't go anywhere in the country. It's too dangerous. But hey, we'll let you go to this camp, go your interview. And when you go to this camp, you see these 200 amputees who are very happy to tell you the story that, yes, they were poor peasants in their field and they were amputated by these horrible rebels when they came here, blah, blah, blah. And when we went there the first time, that's exactly the story we got. But something sounded so unreal that I returned without this time the government, because of course the first time we went there, it was with a representative of the government who had taken us there and organized the interviews, etc. Mm-hmm. So I returned without the government. And I went to these guys, the same guy that I interviewed the first time, and said, look, you told me that you were imprisoned by the rebels in your village, blah, blah, blah. But there was no rebel attack there. And, of course, when they are confronted to the fact, they say, oh, well, no, that's true. That was not the rebels who amputated us. So who was it? Well, it was the militia government. So it was the peacekeepers financed of the by the United Nations. Or it was the army, etc. And when you ask, well, why did you tell me that? Well, the answer is simple. It's because we are paid to tell you that. You know, and that's a very great example of media manipulation, like it happens everywhere in the world. We now... I think that the governments all around the world, or the whatever power in, or whatever force in power in the country, had become expert in manipulating the media, you know, to get attention, to get funding, to get arms, to get whatever it is. And
well,
Thailand was a great example for that.
I absolutely understand that. I mean, I know as a Palestinian activist for the rights of the Palestinian people in this conflict, many times we have had to endure this kind of propaganda-style media that Israel puts out, and you know, you always wonder how can we ever overcome and get to the point where we show people the truth without becoming propagandists.
Absolutely,
and it's a very difficult. Let's go on to another genre that I just found was just totally fascinating. Now and Later.
Okay.
Wow.
Oh, you saw that too. You saw everything.
Wow.
Yeah, that was different. In fact, it's kind of the same approach, if you will.
It is. Actually, technically, it is the same approach, but you're just using a completely different synapsis, free-spirited, liberal, loving, vibrant, glowing human being, and this man that has, you know, this Bill. And it's like this Bill. He's rich and he's powerful and driven to the point of being blinded. Now, isn't that exactly what we're dealing with in Sierra Leone?
Yes, exactly.
When we deal with the rebels that start out for honorable reasons, whatever they were, trying to recapture the resources of the African people, and then they become the enemy of their own people.
Absolutely.
Well, is going on. Talk to us about this now and later. This is a fascinating piece.
So, well, to explain to your audience, I would say Now and Later is a feature film that I wrote and directed, which will be released probably early next year, because you saw it, not even a totally finished film. But
exactly.
And I wrote it because I was so shocked by the hypocrisy of American culture, where, you know, that's the first thing that every foreigner will tell you when they arrive in America. The first shocking thing is that you look at these, whatever, 95 channels that you have available on TV. But it's the same thing if you look at video game or if you look at any kind of entertainment that you have available in America. And the first thing you see is that you have on the screen, like, for available for everybody to see from morning to night, and I'm, of course, thinking of the kid or the teenagers, the most extreme violence that you can imagine. That, you know, honestly, I'm ready to throw up sometime when I see these horror movies or these extremely violent things where you have monsters and people being disembodied and head being thrown off, whatever it is. You know, it's like you have this extreme violence, and that is fine, for parents, it's fine to let their kids watch that. But anything about sex is absolutely taboo and can't be even shown in any shape or form. You can only talk about it. So Now and Later, I did exactly the opposite. I decided to talk about the violence, and I'm talking, of course, about the political, violence of, let's say, the American Empire, and show the sex to see what I would get as a reaction. And I'm sure the reaction will be, very, very hard, when we release the film. But that's an interesting experiment, and it's why, I created these two characters. The first one is this immigrant, from Latin America, who is full of soul and life and, and who has a real, attitude in life, versus this of the guy who is a former banker who had been playing with the depth of...
Even the word banker just sounds like...
Right, exactly.
It sounds like he was a former banker.
Investment banker who had been playing with the depth
That's even worse. You know that, Philippe.
Third world countries. Yes, absolutely. But, you know, it's totally true, and it's inspired by, you know, people who really existed. You know, you have all these guys who play with the depth of third world countries, you know, and plunge these countries in the worst situation because, you know, they, you know, for example, you go and you buy the debt of, there are many examples in history. You buy the debt, Argentina was the big one at the time, but, you know, you had like any country in Africa, whatever, was in the situation where, for example, you have a small country who had like $20 million debt that they can't repay. And of course, so they are in default. And one of these bankers will come to the bank who had lent this money originally. And if it's $20 million, they'll rebuy the debt for, let's say, $1 million. So of course, for the debt is, for the original lender, the bank is a big loss, but at least they have $1 million back. So they are happy to sell that. And after they go to international courts, you know, and sue the countries to get back their $20 million,
exactly.
You know, plus fee, plus interest, plus penalties, plus blah, blah, blah. And usually they won, you know, and that's, you know. So I think it was a great, you know.
Well, this was magnificent. And, you know, I just am thrilled. I can't wait to see it just because of, and I think what I find the most wonderful about the description, the synopsis of the film, is that you linger on the beauty of sexuality and sensuality.
Right, right.
I don't think that you don't gloss over it. As a matter of fact, this is exactly the points that you want to drive in, the fundamental, which brings me to a question. How do you view the fundamental mindset that seems to have risen and taken over a new life here in the United States and around the world? I mean, we're having it, that's exactly what I think is driving you to do this, a film such as this, isn't it?
Well, yeah, you know, I think that we have lost, you know, and not only in the United States, but it's, you know, I think for me, you know, the way of life that you have in the United States or even in European countries or whatever, and is very comparable, or you can really view it the same way that you handle political matters or any other thing like that. What I mean is that I think we have lost touch with reality, with nature, with simple things, and with the truth, with et cetera. Like, for example, as you, I'm sure you know, I'm just finishing a documentary on poverty around the world, you know, like on the true reason of poverty around the world, not like, you know, not like, again, the drought or...
Which you lay a lot of the blame on accidental nations around
That's
the
correct.
World.
Yeah, we lay a lot of blame on us because if you want, and I'll come back to Noyan later because you see it's the same thing. Today we are in a situation where 20% of the planet use 80% of the resources. And we have lost the sense of course, what to do in the world, how to use the resources of our planet. You know, because for 20%, you know, people, 20% of the people of the planet to use 80% of the resources, it means that you have 80% who have to be kept at the level of underdevelopment or poverty, whatever you want to call it. You know, and that sounds totally normal to us today. You know, we have been raised with the idea that some people were born poor and some people were born rich, and that's fine. Like we have been raised, that we are raised with the idea that, you know, sex is bad and violence is good, or at least it's acceptable, you know, and it's the same thing. I think we have lost sense, we have totally lost touch with nature. You know, if you go, and you know, and it's very interesting when you travel in the world, go to see, like, you have some African people, or you have South American tribes who are still in touch with nature. And when you spend a little bit of time with them, you know, we were with, like, you know, totally different people, like for this documentary, we went all around the world and we spent time, you know, with, you know, the different tribe around the world. And when you spend time with these people, you look at yourself and you say, oh my God, we are so far from any contact with nature or any sense of reality or any sense of, that it's scary. it's honestly very scary. And I think if you want, for me, it's the same thing. You know, the Knowing Later, which is talking about, you know, sex and violence or poverty around the world or the disinformation and the manipulation of the media, et cetera, it's all the same thing. Is that we went so far, you know, when you look at what's going on today in America, the lies and the manipulation even of the government, you know, take a little bit of distance, take two steps back and think, how can a government be lying clearly about issues like the war, for example? How did we arrive to that? You know, and how is it acceptable? And how is it, you know, because what are the consequences of these lies is like you have thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people dead. But what are the consequences in terms of the people who did that? None. Absolutely none.
You know, Philippe, I have a theory about that myself. I believe that we have been so indoctrinated by such limited forms of media, limited forms of entertainment, limited forms of our visual and our perception of what real is altered. It, like right here, Angela, your character in the film, Now and Later, so, she lives on a terrace of a transient hotel, and from there, you can see all levels of society.
Correct.
Does filmmaking, the kind of films that you make, allow you to see all levels of society more clearly?
Correct. That's correct.
And I think that's the key. I think that's, that goes back to the hunger of people for truth in cinema, truth in media, truth in visual perceptions. Stop lying to my eyes.
Absolutely. No, I absolutely agree. And like for example, for this documentary on poverty, we went in Venezuela, in Bolivia, in Brazil, in Tanzania, in Kenya, and went all around Europe and the U.S. to interview experts and this and that. And when you look at the situation today, you know, today in the world, you still have slaves, but like real slaves who are not paid to do a work, who are born and raised in plantation, but are owned big multinational corporations, and who will, with their family, work from morning to night to just food and shelter. That's slavery, you know. And you can still find that. And when you look at that, you say, well, how can we still be here in the 21st century when we spend like billions of dollars, you know, throwing bombs, you know, on people, and how can we still be there? And you know, and it's true that the reality, I think, it's really the true answer is because people don't know. They don't know. You know, if you ask people in the street, why is there still poverty in the world? The answer that you'll hear will be like so, you know, confounding that you say, oh my God, people don't know. You know, the reality, I can tell you, after, you know, we went everywhere and we interviewed all the experts all around the world and professors and ministers and whatever and et cetera. And the thing is clear, today, if you look at South America or Africa, we can say today that, you know, they are in this situation because of globalization. But globalization, as it started in the 15th century, you know, when the conquistador arrived in South America, you know, took control of all the richness, all the land, all the resources that these people are. And it went from, you know, to make a long story short, it went from, you know, this European control to U.S. control. But people are still today in the same situation than they were in the 15th century. And why? Because we need to continue to exploit their resources. If not, the system of 20% of the people that we are use 80% of the planet's resources doesn't work anymore. You know?
Well, we've done a number of shows, including one of our shows with a gentleman by the name of John Perkins, who wrote the best-selling...
He's part of the movie. He's a very close friend.
Oh, is he right? And which is it? Yeah. Which in and of, he spoke deeply on these issues, so I know that a lot of our listeners have become more comfortable and more familiar with this kind of understanding of what really is happening. So I think that compounded with a visual sense of cinema that as you're presenting is going to just drive that in more real. You know, today I was really dumbfounded when I was watching CNN for a few minutes, and there was a special about a new bulletproof backpack that children can wear to school, and so that in case of a shooting incident, they can protect themselves. And you wrote, the United States is probably the only country in the world where teenagers go to school with guns and shoot their friends. That was bone-chilling to me. And when I saw this tonight, I could just all I could do was focus on those words that you said.
Oh, thank you. But, you know, it's funny that you mentioned John Perkins, because John, apart from being a great friend of mine, you know, he's a wonderful human being. And when I was so impressed when I read, you know, Confession of an Economic Hitman, that I contacted him to be part of the movie, of course, and he is a big part of the movie about poverty around the world.
Oh,
but
wonderful.
I also offered him to go around the world and go, like, all around the world where he went as an economic hitman and do a TV series, you know, in all this country to explain why this country, it would be one episode per country, you know, and to explain why this country are today in this situation, but from his point of view, a former economic hitman, and what we did to these countries. And it's called One Country at a Time. The TV series is called One Country at a Time. We already shot.
And countries are actually allowing him to do this?
You know,
that's what I'm finding to be very interesting. Are they actually going to allow it?
There are some countries which will welcome us. Like, for example, we did the pilot already that we shot in Bolivia. You know, we went together in Bolivia and we interviewed, of course, the ministers and the economists and the this and the that and the people on the ground, of course. So, because they are the kind of countries who will be very happy to have us, you know, coming here to tell the truth. There are other countries that we will have to be, like, you know, unnoticed. And go, like, let's say, underground, but that's fine. You know, John is always ready for these kind of things, and I'm ready too, you know. So that's our next project, actually. You know, like, we shot the pilot. We are trying to raise the financing today, but as you can imagine, it's not easy to raise financing for a TV series like that. But we are working on that, and that's the next thing I want to do.
Well, from everything that I can gather, especially reading the synopsis of Now and Later, is that you believe that there's not enough love in the world, and that's probably part of the point. Now, obviously, you use the basic instincts of sexuality and sexual impulses and the natural sexual impulses.
Right, right.
I don't want to present that and to portray that. Do you see repressive cultures as a path for altered realities that could, in fact, nurture more violence?
You know, I think that there are a lot of points of view about that. People have different approach and this and that. But what I really try to do in Now and Later is to bring back sexuality as something natural. I didn't try to portray a certain way or another way, just something natural, which is part of life. You know, it's, what always surprised me is that, you know, I don't have kids. I hope I have to have one someday. But, you know, if I was a parent with kids or teenagers, you know, I can understand that some people who have, for example, strong religious belief or whatever, would like to protect their kids from any kind of violence or what they consider they should not watch, like sex, for example. Why not? That I understand that. But I have a very hard time to understand, you know, and that goes back to your question, I have a very hard time to understand how people would prefer to let their kids watch this horrible violence that they will never have to deal with in life. You will never have to deal with a monster tearing up the guts of someone in life, right? But they will have to deal with sex. No question about that, in one way or another. But they prefer to have them, you know, to have them fed with this horrible violence than to see any kind of sexual image, which is, again, something natural that they should teach them about. Right? And that's what shocked me the most. And I would say it is true that, you know, there are a lot of very interesting philosophers who have worked on that and who have worked on these questions. And, you know, it's clear that, you know, the Judeo-Christian, you know, time, you know, which happened a long time ago, started to change the approach that we had with sexuality. And started to go from something natural where, you know, you have a lot of works being done in anthropology or this or that, which, you know, which shows that in the past it was something natural that people would consider as something like eating or sleeping or anything like that, to something which is, you know, become this very special thing that you can show, that you can talk about, that you do like in closed rooms rather than, you know, wherever you want. So I think the time changed that a lot, and I think that, you know, there are even a lot of very strong studies, like by Wilhelm Reich, for example, who is this great German philosopher, who showed that there is a clear relation between sex and violence, which is the sexless society lives in violence. You know, and that I think it's a very strong statement. If you look around the world, let's go back even to tribes who still live a free sexuality. They have no violence whatsoever. You know, and I think there's a very strong relationship with that. And of course, again, we lost touch with the natural thing that we should deal with in order to deal with violence and other things like that.
For those of you that have just joined us, we are speaking with Philippe Diaz of Cinema Libre Studio in Los Angeles, California. Philippe is taking questions from audience members, and you can call in at our internationally toll-free number, 888-228-4494. Again, that's 888-228-4494. We do have a call from Mike from California.
Hi. Hi, Philippe.
Hi, Mike.
My name is Mike, and my question for you is, is Cinema Libre Studios doing anything in particular upcoming, or have they done in the past any documentaries on the Iraq War and the tie-in to what's going on with the Bush administration, et cetera?
Yes, actually, we did quite a lot of those, and, you know, some people would even think too many. So we started by co-producing and distributing Robert Greenwald's movie called Uncovered the War in Iraq, you know, and that was, you know, I would say very secure. It was the first movie who denounced the manipulation of the Bush administration on the Iraq War. It was released in theaters and on DVD and on TV, et cetera, et cetera. That was in like 4 years ago already, I think. And we did another movie called Mission Accomplished about the true situation on the ground in Iraq. And we did WMD, Weapons of Mass Deception, which is about the manipulation of the media as well. What else did we do? Yeah, I think we did, you know, we did quite a lot of that, yes. It's very hard, you know, to be socially or politically conscious and want to do things like that and not deal with the Iraq War.
And extradite yourself from Iraq. Let me ask you, Philippe, in light of, as a matter of fact, I believe it was today or yesterday, President Bush was talking about the fact that Iran might be pushing into some kind of nuclear holocaust, were the exact terms that he used, which is a very, very frighteningly and powerfully aggressive statement, in my opinion. For the president of, for all intents and purposes, what is called the greatest nation on the face of the planet, to use these terms, how do you feel about hearing something like that?
Well, you know, I think that we got in this what we would call New World Order, you know, which is, again, for me, is the same thing that the continuation of what we started in the 15th century with, you know, the new empire, the new European empire, and it transferred to the American empire. And today we are in this situation where there is no going back. Like, it's clear, in order to maintain our level of growth or even our level of our way of life, you know, we have to maintain 80% of the planet in this underdevelopment, and we have to continue to steal their resources, and we have to continue to, you know, force them to buy our products, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, and there is no question for people who are coming from the culture or the, you know, the mentality like Bush and all his cronies. You know, there's no question that, you know, we got Iraq. It's clear that now we are in control of the oil and the water, because the water is a big story, of course, in the Middle East. And there's, of course, a geopolitical issue there, you know, which is to control with Israel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and now what is next? And next, it can be Iran, it can be Syria, it can be Jordan, it can be some other country in Africa, it can be some country in South America. And you will always have, you know, these people who will be pushing this agenda, which is we need to be in control of two-thirds of the world in order, again, to continue our level of growth. If you think about it, there is, you know, we interviewed this great economist called Serge Latouche, who is French and who is economist and, you know, and professor, et cetera, et cetera. And he says, as an economist, I don't even understand how we can still continue, because just look, you know, at this situation of, again, you know, we are using 80% of the resources of the planet. But even in this situation, we are so indebted as a country. I'm talking about the U.S., but the European is the same, that we are living today on borrowed money, which will impact the next 10 years of functioning of the U.S. The Europe is a little bit less than that. It's the next 4 years. But how can it still continue? Even economically speaking, it makes no sense. You know, but that's the only way that we can maintain this level of growth. You know, if we were, you know, if we were, you know, trying to be more fair and more, you know, to the third world countries, we would have to, everything would collapse. You know, there's another professor that we interviewed in Caracas, I believe, who said if we don't continue to give our natural resources to the North, meaning to, you know, the U.S. and Europe, the entire model collapses. And of course, it's the case. You know, so if you want to, that's the answer for Iran, meaning do we need the oil in Iran? Oh, of course, absolutely. So we will have to get it one way or another, either by unfair trade, either by debt, you know, like John Birkin explained very clearly, how do we indebt this country, so therefore after that they have to give the oil for free or something like that, or by war. You know, it's another form of colonialism. You know, it's either with weapons, or with trade system, with debt, and, you know, and the IMF and the World Bank have been, you know, the greatest tool to, you know, to get these natural resources, but we'll have to get them one way or another.
Absolutely. You know, when I think of these things, and when I think of the beginnings of the war of Iraq and all of the stuff that came up about that, I recall the beating that France took. You were born in Paris, France, and you studied at La Sorbonne in Paris. How did you feel? How were you feeling during all of that?
During what? I'm sorry.
During the attack on France that
France, you know, I would say
it took quite a beating, actually. American fries and all.
Yeah, you know, to be honest with you, I don't really feel French. You know, I feel like, because, you know, I've been living here for 15 years or more, you know, mm-hmm. I would say I feel more like a citizen of the world, and I'm ready to go anywhere that I'm needed. And if tomorrow, you know, like I went in Sierra Leone to make this movie or wherever, if tomorrow I feel that there is something to do in Venezuela, I'll go in Venezuela. So I would say I think that there is a moment where you can feel too close to your roots, because that would be a way to, you know, take you away from doing things. So, you know, so I would say, you know, I don't really feel for the French, especially mainly now that we have, you know, the friend of George Bush heading our government. You know, I feel even less French now than I feel before.
So I guess we're in the same situation right here. You know, as a major in philosophy at Le Sorbonne, do you feel that the cinema has been an extension of your portrayal of your own personal philosophies?
Well, I would say, you know, yes, in a way, yes, because what philosophy did, you know, it gave me, you know, an opening mind to look at things in the world in a different perspective. But the cinema did something else, which is, you know, I can answer you in another way. I would say, when I did the movie on Sierra Leone and we opened it at the Cannes Film Festival and this and that, and it went everywhere in the world, so many times I had journalists asking me, why do you make this kind of movie? Why do you risk your life to make this kind of film? It's crazy. And my answer was, and I think it's an honest answer, is that I don't think I'm courageous enough to take a weapon and fight, so I take a camera instead. You know, it's more safe in a way. You know, but I believe that if I was more courageous, the only attitude I could have looking at what's going on in the world is to take a weapon and fight, you know. But I, you know, again, I think it's more...
Well, in effect, didn't you take a weapon and fight? You took your camera, you took your writing, you took your...
Correct,
And you're fighting the fight.
That's correct. That's what I'm trying to do. So yes, definitely, movies is definitely an extension of philosophy, because even, you know, I produced a lot of feature films in the past, you know, when I was in Europe or here, and all these feature films were always trying to explain, you know, in different way, shape, or form, you know, something very serious which is happening in the world, a cultural issue, a social issue, et cetera, by ways of fiction. You know, like you have great directors around the world who have been doing that forever, like Ken Loach and all these guys. You know, they spend their life making stories to explain people what's going on in the world. You know, and that's, I think movies is a great tool for that. You know, like when you are in a closed theater, when it's dark and you are looking at a screen, it's very hard to not listen to what you are told, you know. So I think it's a great, great tool. You know, you can always drop a book. You know, you start to read a book and you decide to go something else, you drop it. It's hard. It's harder to drop, you know, what you are watching in a movie theater.
Philippe, which of the films that you have personally been involved with do you feel is your most important work?
Well, you know, I think a filmmaker always feels that the latest one is the most important because it's the result of so much work. You know, like, you know, this movie that we have been doing on poverty, which is temporarily called Access Denied, you know, is something, it's kind of for me the result of, you know, I would say all my life of studies and work. You know, I spend my life working, reading books about, you know, economical, political issues and this and that. And I have been, you know, studying this. You know, I think that people don't understand what's going on in the world. And what I'm trying with this movie is to show them, you know, what we don't see usually, to tell them what we don't hear usually, you know. And so, of course, I would say I'm the most devoted to that today, you know. So now, you know, I produced a lot of movies in the past, as you may know. I did The Bengali Night with Hugh Grant and John Hurt in India to talk about cultural issues between people. I did the first movie about AIDS, which was, you know, Bad Blood, Mauvais Sang, by Leo Carax, which was the first starring role of Juliette Binoche. And, you know, these movies, they are very close to my heart, of course, but I would say, you know, again, I think it's fair to say that the, you know, this movie on poverty is the most important for me today.
And I go back to something that you said about Now and Later. I wish every Bill to meet his Angela.
That's right.
Is there a bit of the romantic there?
Oh, no, of course, because I think that, you know, I think that we are living in such a complex society where everything is hidden, and the culture will not tell you the truth and will not help you to get raised and to evolve in a normal way, that any help you can get is great. And, of course, the romantic help is the best you can get, because with the love involved, it will open your mind in a way that nothing else can. And it's true, definitely, that there is a lot of autobiographical elements in this movie, and I think it's true. I wish that every Bill who doesn't know much about what's going on in the world would meet his Angela, who would open his mind and show him the truth about himself and about the world, definitely.
You know, now that you mentioned John Perkins, I'd like to ask you, one of the things that most impressed me about John, and especially when I was doing the research on the interview with him, was his still, and this is an amazing thing, his faith in humanity.
That's right.
And that was kind of stunning, especially coming from somebody like that. Coming from somebody like you, I can say, well, you have this deep abiding faith that you studied philosophy, you have done these incredible documentaries.
Thank you.
do you still have that much faith in humanity?
Well, yes, and I would say I can tell you what I think for what did that for John, and I'll answer for me. It's just my personal point of view. Of course, he can answer that better than me. But I think John was lucky enough when he was very young, when he just got out of economic school, you know, to get involved with, you know, this very primitive tribe in South America, in Ecuador, which are the Shuar. And I think they open his mind to another form of life, another way of, another culture, another way of communicating, another way of behaving. And I think he kept that in himself, you know, all through these years of economic things that he did and these economic hitman things. And I think he always kept that and always returned there. And he got involved in shamanism and in all this kind of other type of experience. and he's not even teaching shamanism and all that. And I think that kept him, you know, to go totally 100% in this other world where, you know, people kill each other and for economic reason and this and that.
Well, and I could just go on like this forever. I think this is just amazing. I really appreciate you being with us, but I'm afraid I didn't even realize how the time has gone by. This has just been the most fun, Philippe, and the most informative and the most in-depth. I mean, really, I just enjoyed hearing you thoroughly. Good luck with all of your endeavors in Cinema Libre Studios, as well as your socially conscious work that is so important. And you're right. You are making a difference with film. Make a difference here. We are all working there.
Thank you again. It was my pleasure to be here.
Our honor. And folks, next week, Daher Jamayel, the independent journalist and the Iraqi correspondent, will be with us September 4th at 8 Eastern Time on the People Speak Social Issues. Thank you very much for being with us, and good luck, and time to go, guys. It's over.
This land is mine, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went walking that ribbon of highway, I saw love made that endless skyway, and I saw below me a golden valley, and I said this land was made for you and me. I roamed and I rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. And all around me, a voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. There was a high wall there that tried to stop me, and there was a sign that said, it said private property, but on the other side it didn't say nothing. Oh, that sign was made for you and me. And the sun came shining when I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling, and a voice was chanting that the fog was lifting. Yeah, this land was made for you and me. One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the sea wall, by the relief on the fast, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me.